20. That individual philosophical ideas are not something spontaneous, not things which grow out of themselves, but develop connected to and in relationship with each other, so that no matter how suddenly and arbitrarily they may appear to emerge in the history of thinking, they nevertheless belong to a system just as much as do the collective members of the fauna of a continent. That point finally reveals itself by the way in which the most diverse philosophers reliably keep filling out again and again a certain ground plan of possible philosophies. Under an invisible spell, they always run around the same orbit all over again. They may feel they are still so independent of each other with their critical or systematic wills, but something or other in them leads them. Something or other drives them in a particular order one after the other, that very inborn taxonomy and relationship of ideas. Their thinking is, in fact, much less a discovery than a recognition, a remembering again, a journey back home into a distant primordial collective household of the soul, out of which these ideas formerly grew. To practice philosophy is to this extent a form of atavism of the highest order. The strange family similarity of all Indian, Greek, and German ways of practicing philosophy can be explained easily enough. It's precisely where a relationship between languages is present that we cannot avoid the fact that, thanks to the common philosophy of grammar, I mean thanks to the unconscious mastery and guidance exercised by the same grammatical functions, everything has been prepared from the beginning for a similar development and order of philosophical systems, just as the road to certain other possibilities of interpreting the world seems sealed off. There will be a greater probability that philosophers from the region of the Ural-Altaic language, in which the idea of the subject is most poorly developed, will look differently into the world and will be found on other pathways than Indo-Germans or Muslims. The spell of particular grammatical functions is, in the final analysis, the spell of physiological judgments of value and racial conditions. So much for the repudiation of Locke's superficiality in connection with the origin of ideas. 21. The causa sui, something being its own cause, is the best self-contradiction which has been thought up so far, a kind of logical rape and perversity. But the excessive pride of human beings has worked to entangle itself deeply and terribly with this very nonsense. The demand for freedom of the will, in that superlative metaphysical sense, as it unfortunately still constantly rules in the heads of the half-educated, the demand to bear the entire final responsibility for one's actions oneself, and to relieve God, the world, ancestors, chance, and society of responsibility for it, is naturally nothing less than this very causa sui, and an attempt to pull oneself into existence out of the swamp of nothingness by the hair, with more audacity than Munchausen. Suppose someone in this way gets behind the boorish simplicity of this famous idea of the free will and erases it from his head. Then I would invite him to push his enlightenment still one step further, and erase also the inverse of this idea of free will from his head. I refer to the unfree will, which leads to an abuse of cause and effect. People should not mistakenly reify cause and effect the way those investigating nature do, and people like them who nowadays naturalize their thinking, in accordance with the ruling mechanistic foolishness which allows causes to push and shove until they have an effect. People should use cause and effect merely as pure ideas, that is, as conventional fictions for the purpose of indicating and communicating, not as an explanation. In the in itself, there is no causal connection, no necessity, no psychological unfreedom, and hence no effect of the cause, no law holds sway. We are the ones who have, on our own, made up causes, causal sequences, for one another, relativity, compulsion, number, law, freedom, reason, and purpose. And when we fabricate this world of signs inside things as something in itself, when we stir it into things, then we are once again acting as we have always done, namely, mythologically. The unfree will is a myth. In real life, it's simply a matter of strong and weak wills. It is almost always already a symptom of something lacking in a thinker himself, once he senses in all causal connections and psychological necessity some purpose, necessity, inevitable consequence, pressure, and unfreedom. That very feeling is a telltale giveaway. The person is betraying himself. And if I have seen things correctly, the problem of the unfreedom of the will has generally been seen from two totally contrasting points of view, but always in a deeply personal way. Some people are not willing at any price to let go of their responsibility, their belief in themselves, their personal right to the credit. The vain races belong to this group. The others want the reverse. They don't wish to be responsible for or guilty of anything, and demand, out of an inner self-contempt, that they can shift blame for themselves somewhere else. People in this second group, when they write books, are in the habit nowadays of taking up the cause of criminals. A sort of socialist pity is their most attractive disguise. And in fact, the fatalism of those with weak wills brightens up amazingly when it learns how to present itself as la religion de la souffrance humaine, the religion of human suffering. That's its good taste.